We thank you, Lord. We bless you and ask that you be with us as we study together on this Shabbat. Amen. Okay, so we are in Deuteronomy chapter 16 through 21. This portion is called Shoftim, Judges, but we're actually going to talk about something else, the Shotrim, the officers. It begins, "Hi, I'm Daniel Lowenstein, and you're watching Aleph Beta. Welcome to Parshat Shoftim." In this parsha, we learn about the command to appoint Shotrim. You know, Shotrim, the ones with the super important jobs, the ones who do the, What do the Shotrim do? Well, the word Shotrim means officers or enforcers, and in modern Hebrew, Shotrim are the police. So, is that what the biblical Shotrim are? Is their job to give us tickets for kashrut violations, violating the dietary laws, or arrest people who fall behind on their tithes? Do they have undercover units that bust up idolatry cells? The truth is, we know almost nothing about the job of the Shotrim from the Torah. In fact, they only have one job that we actually hear about, and it doesn't sound anything like the role of a police officer or enforcer. In Devarim, Deuteronomy chapter 20, the Torah talks about war, and it describes this kind of scripted scene that's supposed to happen before a battle is joined. It starts with a Kohen, a priest, approaching the people, Ve'nigash HaKohen, and reassuring them that they shouldn't be afraid because God is with them. And once that's done, then that's when we meet the Shotrim. They stay up, they step up. And you know what they do? They send people home. They say, "Mi ha'ish asher b'na bayit, bayit chadash, v'lo chanacho." If anyone built a new house but hasn't lived in it yet, yelid v'yashov levato, go, leave, and return home. Go break in that house. And if anyone's planted a vineyard but hasn't gotten to enjoy its fruit, same deal. Yelid v'yashov levoto, go home. Or if a person is betrothed and is waiting to get married, or even if he is just scared and he might bring down morale, once again, yelid yevasho levoto, go home. So let me ask you, is that the kind of thing you'd expect a police officer to say? Sir, are you aware that you were traveling 20 miles over the speed limit? That's a pretty hefty ticket right there. Oh, wait. Do you by any chance have a new house? Well, you should have said something. Go on home and we'll forget all about this. It's ridiculous. It's insane. Any officer who said that clearly doesn't understand the job. Police maintain order, and they do that by holding people accountable. So why are the Shotrim, the supposed enforcers, letting people off the hook? I think that there might be a clue to solving this mystery in another place in the Torah. See, this isn't the first place where we hear about Shotrim. There's actually another place way back in the book of Shemot, in the book of Exodus, where we hear all about another set of Shotrim. Shotrim who actually act like enforcers. So maybe if we read that first story about Shotrim in Shemot, it can give us some answers about the strange role of the Shotrim we're seeing here. So let's go to the book of Shemot and see what we see. Here's the scene. Moshe and Aaron have just told Pharaoh to let the Israelites go for the very first time. And Pharaoh is unimpressed. But he doesn't just say no. He actually pushes back. Here's what happens. Vayatzav paro bayom hahu et hagnogshim ba'am ve'et shot rav lemor. On that day, Pharaoh issued a command to the nation's taskmasters. And their shodrim, their officers, there they are. And Pharaoh tells them, Lo tisafun letet tevel la'am libon havenim kitmo shilshom. Don't continue to provide straw like you have been. Hem yalchu v'koshu tevel. Tevel, let the people go and gather it from themselves, for themselves. I want the bricks at the same rate. I've been getting them up till now, but I want you to make them gather the raw materials too. In other words, pile on the work and bury them with it. So here we've got our shotrim, and they do sound a lot more shotrimish than the ones in Shoftim, right? They sound like enforcers. Pharaoh issues commands, and they're the ones whose job it is to make sure that the job is done. So we've got Shotrim here in Shemot, and we've got Shotrim in our Parsha, but this is where the similarity ends? Is that the only thing that connects these two stories? And then he writes, I don't think so. So let me ask you, what's the power structure here in Shemot? Who's in charge of whom? Well, the Israelites are clearly at the bottom. They're the slaves. But go back to that verse. Vayatzav paro bayom hahu et hagnoshim ba'am ve'et shot rav. Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters and the officers. So that means we've got officers and taskmasters in the middle, and at the top, we've got Pharaoh, the king, the one making the laws, the one telling his officers what commands to give the people. Well, what about the structure in Shoftim, in our pre-battle scene? Well, you've also got the Israelite people and the Shoftim, the Shotrim above them, the officers above them, giving the people directions. And you've got the Kohen, the priest, who opens the scene with his words of reassurance and inspiration. And there's also someone on top of the Kohen, someone telling the Kohen and the officers what to say, what commands to give the people. And that means that in both places we're seeing the same four-level structure. The people at the very top, the king at the bottom, the king at the very top, and in the middle, these two intermediate positions, Shotrim and another role. In Shemot, the taskmasters, and in Shoftim, the Kohen. And let's zero in for a moment or a minute on the Cohen taskmaster connection. Let me let Ray in. Do you remember the way the Torah introduces the part of the Cohen before his speech? Hello, Ray. We're a few pages in at this point, a couple of pages. The first thing the Cohen is supposed to do is draw close to the people. V'nigash ha-kohen. Nigash, nun, gimel, shin. That's the same way you spell nogesh, taskmaster. Obviously, just the vowels are different, same consonants. I think the Torah is hinting to us that the kohen and the taskmasters are inverse parallels of each other. One is a nigash, someone who draws close to the people to inspire and uplift, and one is a nogesh, someone who oppresses the people and beats them down. So we've got the Shoatrim connection, the power struggle, a structure connection, and the Nogesh Nigash connection. And if we read through the story carefully, I think we can see one more connection. If you look through the story in Shemot, there's a word that keeps coming up, a word that Pharaoh and the Shoatrim both use in their commands to the people. Lech, go. Lechu lesiv levotechem, says Pharaoh. Go back to your burdens. Hem yalchu the koshu. Let them go and do the gatherings. Lechu kechu lachem tevel. Say the Shoatrim, go. Take straw. The who ivdu, go and get to work. The word go by itself is completely neutral, but in Egypt it picks up this awful connotation of oppression. Go, bear your burdens, stop complaining because nobody cares. Now look at Shoftim. Do we find that same word coming up in our scene? We do. It's in the words the Shoatrim say to the people as they're sending them home. Whoever built a new house, Yelech Vayashov Lebeito, go, but not to work. Go home. Leave your work behind. And it's the same for every line they say. Whoever planted a vineyard, whoever is betrothed, whoever is afraid. Yelech Yevashov Veyashov Leveto. It's that same word that had the oppressive meaning in Egypt, yet here it means the opposite. When you add it all up, it sounds like everything about our pre-battle scene in Shoftim, the Kohen, the Shoatrim, the directions to the people, it's all based on Egypt. God is taking Pharaoh's system and using it as a model for his own system. But why? Why would he do that? Well, I have a theory, David says, and to explain it, I'd like to tell you about a conversation I had a few years ago. I had a friend who ran the billing department of a hospital, and we were talking about some of the things he learned from his job. And he told me that he had this one rule of management that was the most important thing he learned. He said that when someone asks for time off to spend time with a sick relative or to watch a school play, you always find a way to give it to them. If it means they'll have to make up the hours or someone will have to cover shifts or whatever it is, you figure it out and make it work. You have to make sure they know that you see them as people and you have their backs, because there's nothing more demoralizing than having a boss who thinks your life doesn't matter. That all you are is part of the machine. And if your life interferes with that, that makes you worthless, makes you a liability. No one wants to work in a place where the job means everything and you mean nothing. But that's exactly the system that Pharaoh was building in Egypt. He treated the Israelites like they were his brick factory. And the minute they expressed a personal interest, asked for a break to go serve their God, he added more work until their needs and wants as individual people were crushed under its weight. And so God comes and says, I also have a lot of work for you to do. I've got hundreds of commands for you to follow so that you can bring about my will. But I don't see my will the same way Pharaoh saw his. It's not supposed to overwhelm you and crush you until there's no place left for your personal concerns. I respect you. I see the fundamental dignity of every person, and I want you to be able to experience the personal joys of your lives. And so I have a different law enforcement system. On the surface, it might look the same, like the same system as Pharaoh. I'm at the head, and I've got these officers who see that the people do my will. But instead of a Nogesh, a taskmaster, someone who oppresses, I have a Nigash, someone who draws near, someone who uplifts. Instead of Shodrim demanding people get to work, I have Shodrim who tell people to go home. When there are people on the verge of important milestones, like getting married or breaking in a new house, and if they fight for me, they might never get to have those experiences. I don't want that. I care about my mission, but I care about my people too. The Torah doesn't tell us anything about what Shodrim do, except for this one law about sending people home from the front lines. And I think the reason is that the job of the Shodrim is mostly self-evident. If you're setting up a system of police, then yeah, obviously they're going to be expected to enforce the law. But what the Torah did choose to elaborate on was something that wasn't obvious. The fact that, as the Shodrim are going about enforcing the law, it's also their job to respect and care about the people. And the importance of upholding the law can't overshadow that. Do the rules need to be upheld? Of course. But never to the point where you violate human dignity. That's Pharaoh's way, not God's. So, these last several paragraphs speak to us regarding our own system of policing and what is sometimes the violation of human rights and the consequences of doing that. So our policing system should be set up along the lines of God's policing system in the scripture. And there are obviously many occasions when that is the case, when that is true, and others, sadly, when it's not. One of the things that I wanted to talk about just briefly, I'm just going to make a comment about it, is in his discussion, Daniel says, Daniel Lowenstein, I think I referred to him as David earlier, Daniel Lowenstein, the truth is we know almost nothing about the job of the Shodrim from the Torah. And I added, this is another example of the necessity of an oral Torah. We talked about this a good deal last Shabbat, right? That we have an oral Torah to help us understand the various references that are not explained in the written Torah, and this happens to be another one. Number two, I think the Torah is hinting to us that the Kohen and the taskmasters are inverse parallels of each other. One is a Nagash, someone who draws close to the people to inspire and uplift, and one is a Nogesh, someone who oppresses the people and beats them down. And I make the observation that this same type of antithetical quality characterizes the role of the Messiah and the anti-Messiah. If you look at number one, the Messiah facilitates salvation, freedom, and self-awareness. The anti-Messiah, invigorated by Satan, by the enemy, facilitates bondage, conformity, and ignorance. And there are many passages that speak to this. I chose two, one from Isaiah 53, that speaks of the servant of God, the Messiah, pouring out his life unto death. He was numbered with the transgressions. He bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. And from the book of Hebrews, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, that is Satan, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Number two, the Messiah is humble. Satan is arrogant. And by humble, I don't mean weak. In Hebrew, the word humble doesn't mean weak. It means restricting the use of strength for occasions when it's required and not using it when it's not, right? In Matthew 11, Yeshua says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, that my yoke is easy and my burden is light." I mean, he had a tremendous responsibility to reach out to his people, but he doesn't do so aggressively, arrogantly. He doesn't do so in a way that trivializes who they are or what they believe or where they happen to be in their relationship with God, right? He describes himself as gentle and humble in heart. Now, what it says in the scriptures about Satan is the opposite. In Isaiah 14, this is a reference to the king of Tyre, but obviously the passages that we're going to read don't refer to the king of Tyre. They refer to the power behind the king of Tyre, Satan. "How have you fallen from heaven, morning star?" The king of Tyre was never called the morning star. He never fell from heaven, and he was never referred to as the son of the dawn. But Satan is these things. "You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly, on the lofty mountains towards the north. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.'" Number three, the Messiah will reign as king by heritage, by right, in truth. Satan aspires to reign as king by demand, by fabrication, in falsehood. One passage that deals with this is in Psalm 2. "Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us throw off their shackles.' The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger, saying, 'I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree.' He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father.'" This is a way of expressing the right of the Messiah to rule, right? He doesn't acquire his role to rule by demand, by fabrication, by falsehood, but by heritage, by right, in truth. This passage goes on in verse 12 to say, kiss the son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction. So it's a warning to those to show proper respect to the king. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we read about the anti-Messiah, again influenced obviously by Satan. That's where his power, his authority, his charisma comes from. "Don't let anyone deceive you, for that day will not come." The end of the last days will not come until the rebellion occurs. People turn away, turn against God, and the man of lawlessness, this is a reference to the Antichrist or the Anti-Messiah, is revealed. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. In other words, he erects a statue of himself in the temple in Jerusalem as he turns against God's people, people that he earlier had made an agreement with. He turns against God's people and proclaims himself to be God. When I was with you, I used to tell you these things, Paul writes. You know what is holding him back. The Spirit of God is holding him back so that he may be revealed at the proper time. The one who now holds it back will continue to do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Yeshua will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders. By the way, if you have a dispensational commentary, a commentary, a Christian commentary that's authored by a dispensational author, you might find an odd explanation for this passage in verse 7. The one who now holds it back will continue to do so until he is taken out of the way. The one who holds it back in dispensational theology is often identified as the church. The church is the one holding the anti-Messiah back. And when the church is raptured out of this world, then the Antichrist or the Anti-Messiah surfaces and does whatever it is that he does to connect together the world's nations, to make peace, to implement his economic system, right, the mark, without which it's not possible to buy or sell, and then enables the people of Israel to rebuild the temple and all of the other things associated with his coming, right? So it's not something I would say that it's really possible to appreciate from the text itself. This is called not exegesis, right? But the kind of interpretation where you read something into the text that isn't there. It's the Spirit of God that holds back. The Lord is the one who holds back. And he holds it back because it isn't time for him to be revealed. When it is, he will be and will know about it. Okay? Number three. There is much more that could be said about these comparisons, of course, but let's move on. Number three, but that's exactly the system that Pharaoh was building in Egypt. He treated the Israelites like they were his brick factory. And the minute they expressed a personal interest, asked for a break to go serve their God, he added more work until their needs and wants as individual people were crushed under its weight. This following quote comes from a Christian site, gotquestions.org, and oftentimes the answers that they provide to questions are often very good. I don't feel that way about this particular quote. And the reason why it's included is because of what Daniel Lowenstein says here regarding Pharaoh, right? The minute the people expressed a personal interest, asked for a break to go serve their God, Pharaoh added more work until their needs and wants as individual people were crushed under its weight. This is often the way the Torah is characterized in Christian thought, in Christian theology. It's something which crushes God's people under its weight. And so, this observation is often made. Messiah Yeshua redeemed us from the curse that has been brought through the law by becoming a curse for us. He substituted himself in our place and upon the cross took the punishment that is justly ours, so that we are no longer under the curse of the law. It's interesting because in this paragraph, he observes this correctly, right? That we are no longer under the curse of the law. But as soon as he says this, he reverses his position, right? And says, in doing so, he fulfilled and upheld the requirements of the law. This does not mean that Christians are to be lawless, as some advocate today, a teaching called antinomianism. Rather, it means that we are free from the Mosaic law and instead under the law of Messiah, which is to love God with all of our being and to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. Now, what's ironic, of course, has to do with the fact that he says, in doing so, the Messiah fulfilled, which means to fill up in Greek thought, but not in Hebrew. The word fulfill in Greek means to fill up, as if I was pouring something into this cup. When the liquid reaches the brim of the cup, it's full. Right? But the word fulfill in Hebrew, the idiom, means to establish, not to fill up and apparently discard. Right? In other words, this is an idea which never made a good deal of sense to me. When I fill up a cup, well, I rarely fill it up to the brim. There are occasions when we're supposed to. But when I fill up a cup and it's full, I drink from it, right? I don't walk over to the sink and dump out its contents. I benefit from its contents. I establish the veracity of its contents. I establish the truthfulness of whatever it is that the cup has been filled with, right? But here, the Christian view is that the Messiah fulfilled and upheld the requirements of the Torah, which means that we are free now from the Mosaic law, not to live lawlessly, obviously, but instead we are under the law of Messiah. The Mosaic law and the law of Messiah in Christian thought, particularly in dispensational thought, are two different laws. And notice what he says, which is to love God with all of our being and to love our neighbors as ourselves. But where do those two statements come from? From the Torah. These statements are reassessed or restated in the apostolic writings. You know, when Yeshua is questioned and asked, what commandments summarize the whole, or what commandment? And Yeshua says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your soul, all of your heart, all of your might. And there is another one like it. He says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? One a quote from the book of Deuteronomy and one a quote from the book of Leviticus. But these aren't new laws which should be regarded as the law of Messiah. They're Torah laws. They're from the law of Moses. He goes on to write, Messiah became the end of the law by virtue of what he did on earth through his sinless life and his sacrifice on the cross. And this is another irony. Not only is the word end an inaccurate translation of the Greek word telos here, but the fact of the matter is, Gentiles aren't obligated to the Mosaic law. The Torah has a law for Gentiles. It's the Noahide laws, the seven laws that Noah gave mankind after he and his family left the ark. Where in the Bible does it describe non-Jews being obligated to the Mosaic laws? The only way a non-Jew can be obligated to the Mosaic laws is if, number one, in biblical times, he joined himself to the community and embraced the 613 commands as his own, right? Or if a Gentile converted to Judaism and embraced God and the Torah and the Jewish people as their own, that would be among the ways that a Gentile could be held accountable to the Torah. It's true today, too. Converts to Judaism today become obligated to the Torah, which is why rabbis often ask a potential convert, are you sure you want to do this? Right? I mean, right now, you know, you live your life obligated to seven commands, instructions in the Torah. But if you convert to Judaism, you'll be obligated for 613 instructions, right? I mean, 7, 613, 7, 613, 7, 613. Think, man, think. Is that what you want to obligate yourself to? Right? I mean, come on. The point is that only if a person insists does the rabbi go ahead with the process. But the irony is that the only other way Gentiles, Christians, for example, could be obligated to the Torah would be if they have taken the place of Israel in God's heart. Right? As a church, God rejected Israel because they turned away from his law. God raised up a people to take Israel's place. So you would think that if you're going to take Israel's place, that you might be obligated to the same instructions. In replacement theology, that is true. That's what they believe, that the church replaces Israel, right? The church is a separate entity that takes Israel's place. They even refer to themselves as the spiritual Israel, not the physical Israel, because they're not physically connected to Abraham, right? But various passages, like in the book of Galatians, where Paul calls Gentiles who believe children of Abraham by faith, many passages that speak to this, but don't say what people think they say. But the point is that there must be a way to eliminate the observance of the Torah for Christians, because in the words of Daniel Lowenstein, referring to Pharaoh, right? Pharaoh is someone who oppresses the people and beats them down, right? Pharaoh or the instructions he provides, right, are a burden. We labor under this weighty burden, and we are crushed by it because people aren't regarded as having a good deal of value, right? But he goes on to say, so the law, it no longer has any bearing over us because its demands have been fully met in the Lord Yeshua the Messiah. Faith in Messiah, who satisfied the righteous demands of the law, restores us into a pleasing relationship with God and keeps us there, regardless of what we do. No longer under the penalty of the law, we now live under the law of grace. So everything is about grace in the love of God. So it doesn't matter who we are. It doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter what we say. Everything is covered by God's grace. If you look in Romans 10, the NIV translates this passage, the Messiah is the culmination of the law, the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes, right? But this is the way it should be translated from the complete Jewish Bible, for the goal at which the Torah aims is the Messiah, who offers righteousness to everyone who believes or who trusts, right? How is righteousness extended to people who need a relationship with God? By trusting God, right? We acknowledge God and we trust Him. It doesn't require doing away with the Torah, because the Torah was never intended for salvation, right? The Torah is instructions that God has given His people as His people to live by. But notice the MacDonald idiomatic translation. It says it in the same way the NIV does. The terminal point of the law is the Messiah. The Messiah's coming is the terminal point of the law, right? Let's look at this passage in Galatians. Before the coming of this faith, we were held in custody under the law. The law was our guardian until Messiah came, that we might be justified by faith. Now that this faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian, right? But this passage needs to be rethought as well. Paul writes, now before the time for this trusting faithfulness came, we were imprisoned in subjection to the system, which results from perverting the Torah into legalism, kept under guard until this yet-to-come trusting faithfulness would be revealed. The trusting faithfulness was revealed in the Messiah, but the Messiah doesn't abrogate the Torah in the process. He shows us the way the Torah should be properly applied in our lives. Accordingly, the Torah functioned as a custodian until the Messiah came so that we might be declared righteous on the ground of trusting and being faithful. And now that the time for this trusting faithfulness has come, we are no longer under a custodian. In other words, those laws, they are written on our hearts and we follow them. We walk in them naturally by nature. The Torah's true meaning, which the Messiah upholds, Greek ton nomen tau Christo, the law of the Messiah, a phrase found only once in the apostolic writings, but the phrase appears in the Midrash Rabbah, the great Midrash on Ecclesiastes 11. The law of Messiah is the Torah, which a person learns in this world is vanity in comparison with the Torah of the Messiah, right? And the reason why the Torah, which a person learns in this world is vanity when compared to the Torah of the Messiah is because the Torah, the written Torah, leaves out so many details, right? But we see those details applied to the way he treats people in his life. In other words, the Messiah is the living Torah that connects the letter of the Torah and the spirit of the Torah together in a way that Moses intended, but is obviously not recognized to the degree that it should be. And its meaning there is essentially the same in this verse. The Torah as it will be taught by the Messiah himself. The Torah as upheld by the Messiah. Here the question is whether Yeshua instituted a new Torah different from the Torah given at Mount Sinai. In other words, is fulfilling the law of the Messiah different from fulfilling the law of Moses? I express my negative answer in my interpretive rendering, which by its wording excludes the common, but in my opinion mistaken, traditional Christian view that Yeshua abrogated the supposedly legalistic Torah of Moses and inaugurated in its place a law of love. This traditional view comes into direct conflict with one of the most firmly held tenets of Orthodox Judaism and the Judaism of the first century, the eternity or non-abrogability of the Torah. Each morning, Orthodox Jews repeat in their prayers the Yigdal hymn, which affirms that God gave the Torah of truth to his people through the prophet who is faithful in his house. God will not alter his eternal law or exchange it for another. The prophet faithful in his house is Moshe. Yeshua himself reassured his hearers that he had not come to do away with the Torah, to abolish it. However, the eternity of the Torah does allow for changes in its historical manifestation and application to society. Indeed, Judaism itself provides numerous examples. Moreover, Jewish tradition includes a significant strand of expecting that when the Messiah comes, there will be a transformation of Torah. Good. Number three with regard to this matter is from Ephesians. The Messiah himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one, both Jews and Gentiles, and has destroyed the barrier, the machitza, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. Right? This passage is also one of the passages upon which the misinterpretation regarding the abolishing of the Torah exists. This is the way David Stern translates it, which is more to the point. And it doesn't conflict with what other passages in the scriptures say about the Torah, which is, of course, a big problem. I mean, how can Paul write that the Messiah in his flesh has set aside the Torah when Yeshua says, in his own words, that he did not come to set aside the Torah, right? So, who's right? And if you appreciate what I'm trying to express, it makes what the Messiah says from God, given that he is a manifestation of God in the flesh, and it makes Paul a false prophet because he's not teaching what the Torah says in the scripture about itself, right? That it's eternal. It goes on forever. So, what do you do? I mean, I know many people who think that the writings of Paul should be removed from the Bible because of what he seems to say about the Torah. But the problem, of course, is that he doesn't say these things about the Torah. The fact is that his words are interpreted improperly, right? This is the way this passage should have been rendered. For he himself is our shalom. He has made us both one and has broken down the mechitza, the barrier, which divided us, by destroying in his own body, notice, the enmity occasioned by the Torah. He did this in order to create in union with himself from the two groups a single new humanity and thus make shalom. How would doing away with the Torah facilitate making peace between Jews and Gentiles? And why is the Torah something that everyone observes in the millennium when the Messiah comes? And there are passages that address this. The fact of the matter is the Torah calls the Jewish people a chosen people, right? And that has been a source of animosity between Jews and Gentiles for a very, very long time. That source of animosity, which existed in the first century, is at the heart of the way anti-Semitism developed in the early church in the fourth century, right? It is in many ways based on this animosity, this idea that Gentiles, right, that, hey, we are a chosen people too. The fact is that in the Bible, Gentiles are chosen and they're connected to God's promises and to his covenants with Israel, right? That is something that the scripture talks about, but what the scripture does not describe is God rejecting his people Israel and raising up a church in Israel's place so that Israel is now the rejected one and the church is now the chosen one. At any rate, these passages are available for you to read. And one last comment. God says, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach, right? And he goes on at the end of this passage to say, no, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may observe it. But it's not for salvation. Jews have never believed that they are saved by observing the Torah. The Torah was given to Israel after they were redeemed from Egypt. This is a dispensationalism idea. Have there been Jews who have embraced the letter of the Torah without affirming its spirit? Of course. But that is why the connection between them, between the letter and the spirit, is so often emphasized in the teaching of Yeshua. And if you need to see this in print, read the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, right? And this last passage has to do with the extent of God's care for his people. And there are many, many passages that I could have used to describe that too. God does care for his people. And as we discussed last week too, life takes precedence over Torah because of God's great care for his people, right? If it comes to observing Torah or preserving a life, you should preserve a life. This is something which is always true with very few exceptions. One of the most important being embracing idolatry. Embracing idolatry is not regarded as a legitimate way of seeing life take precedence over Torah, right? And so this is something that we could talk about a great deal, but I've reached my time, so I'm going to stop here and to see if there are any comments or observations about what we've discussed.
On that prior page about the enmity occasioned,
yes,
in the Torah, would you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think the enmity that he's referring to, I'm trying to find the text.
Okay.
Let me just, it's on...
Ephesians 2, I believe, the prior page.
Okay.
Number 3, I think.
Is it number 3?
Yes, I don't know 3.
It's number 3?
Yep.
3, a regular 3. Not 3 with a parenthesis, right? Number 3.
Representative.
I'm sure.
It's 3 with a parenthesis. It's Ephesians 2, 14.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, I see it, yeah.
I have CJB.
Right, right, right. Good, I got it. The enmity occasioned by the Torah is the feeling. Sorry? The enmity.
The mic is mute?
My mic is mute?
Yeah.
Yes, your mic is muted. Your mic is muted, Bob. We're not hearing you.
That's weird.
Still muted.
Okay.
Now you're good.
I don't know what happened. Okay. Thank you. The enmity occasioned by the Torah is something that we talked about in our seminar on anti-Semitism. There are many things which distinguish Jews from Gentiles, particularly Gentiles who have been schooled in Greek thought or Western thought, right? There are some similarities with different cultures depending upon where they are in the world and the way their languages work, but there is a significant difference between Greek and Hebrew, between a Jewish worldview and a Western worldview. One of the most significant differences has to do in part with the way Jews think as over against the way Gentiles think, right? The Torah, to the extent that that Westerners have the opportunity to read the Torah, which of course was not possible before the 3rd century, before the Common Era, because there existed no Greek translation of the Torah. But in the 3rd century, the Septuagint was created. The Septuagint was a translation made by 70 scholars. They translated the Torah from Hebrew into Greek, and it was regarded as an exceptionally gifted translation, right? So, Gentiles could read the Torah in what had become the lingua franca of the known world in the 1st century, just the way English is today, right? English is spoken of all over the world, and in the 1st century it was Greek. So commerce, business, transactions of various kinds between nations were often conducted in Greek because it was a well-known language in the 1st century, right? So the Septuagint is a Greek translation which renders the entire Hebrew Bible into Greek, and non-Jews have access to it. But the statements made in the Torah regarding Israel being God's treasured possession, regarding Israel being a chosen people, regarding Israel being loved and loved in a way that gives them a unique place in God's heart, is something that was offensive to Gentiles, and it has always been a source of conflict between Jews and Gentiles. And the way words are understood is a source of conflict between Jews and Gentiles too. Like the passage that we read in Romans 10:4, you know, that the Messiah is the end of the law. The word telos in Greek can mean end, but it can also mean aim or goal or objective of something, right? So the translating committee is the one that translated the word in the NIV from telos into end, so that it reinforces the idea that the Messiah is the end of the law, that he has brought it to its termination point, right? But in Hebrew, that's not what the word means. It means the goal or the objective of it. And ironically, the NIV doesn't translate the word telos as end anywhere else it's used in the apostolic writings, just in that passage, right? When it applies to the love of God, the love of God is the goal of a believer, right? Someone connected to God in relationship with Messiah or through Messiah, right? It's not regarded as the termination of love. It's regarded as the objective of God's love, right? So this is a problem too, because what it means is that when Hebrew is used to explain a concept and then it's translated into Greek, Westerners oftentimes don't understand what the author is actually trying to say, because the words are interpreted differently. They mean different things, right? They use the same words, but they mean different things. An example which I often use to point this out has to do with the word ekklesia in Greek, which is translated in every English translation of the New Testament, of the apostolic writings, right? Christian version as church. But a church is a religious gathering. Greek has a word for a religious gathering, and it's not ekklesia. It's synagogue, right? A synagogue is in Greek a religious gathering. But it can apply to any kind of religious gathering, a coven of witches, people who are engaged in a sexual relationship with a temple priest or priestess, right? It's a form of worshiping the fertility goddess. That's a synagogue, which is why in the book of Acts, whenever the word synagogue is used of a Jewish gathering, it's always referred to as a synagogue of the Jews, right? I mean, nobody would say that today. If I were to go to synagogue next Shabbat, I wouldn't say, you know, I went to the synagogue of the Jews in Eden Prairie and I had a wonderful time. Right? Because you'd think to yourself, synagogue of the Jews, what other kind of synagogue is there? But in the first century, there were hundreds of synagogues, right? In the 21st century in the United States or in the world, throughout the world, there isn't, right? Because the word has been adopted in the Jewish community. The word ekklesia means a secular assembly, a civil assembly, a town meeting. You know, when the members of a community get together to discuss, you know, whether or not, like in our community, because so many ash trees are dying, should the city pay to treat the ash trees so that they don't all die? And if they don't, they'll all be dead by this time next year. And there are hundreds of ash trees in the community, right? So what do? Well, if you want to talk about it and get the public's opinion, you have a meeting, you get the community together, and people voice their opinions with regard to whether or not the trees should be saved, right? But that's an ekklesia, not a synagogue, right? It's an ekklesia. The Greek word is always translated church, but it can't mean that. And, you know, the Greek scholars who made the translation know that, but because their translations are so theology-driven, that's the way they translate it, right? That's the bottom line. How did the audience that Paul was writing to know that ekklesia was his name for a messianic synagogue? Because in the Septuagint, the Greek word ekklesia is always used, no exceptions, always used to translate the Hebrew word kehillah. And in Hebrew, a kehillah can be a religious gathering or a secular gathering, but in modern Hebrew, the word kehillah means synagogue, right? So, Paul's audience knew that. Now, how would they know that? Because they were attending synagogues. Gentile believers were attending synagogues. They were learning Torah. They were being taught what these principles mean and how we apply them to our lives. Paul uses many, many words. Not just a few, many words. Not the way they're used in Greek. And by the way, all the apostolic authors do this. They use words like they're used in Hebrew, not in Greek, right? And it's a problem for Greeks, because for those who even have a heart to want to know what is being said, they can't really appreciate what is being said without attending a Jewish function, right? And why should I attend a Jewish function to understand something that God is trying to communicate to me? Why should I grab onto the tzitzit of a Jew when that's something which I should have to do? So this has always been a source of conflict between Israel and the nations, and it became its most severe beginning in the first century with the coming of Messiah and with Gentiles being connected to whatever messianic synagogues existed in the first century. But prior to that time, Gentiles were involved. Those who had a heart for God were involved in synagogues, right? Regular synagogues. And they, like Cornelius, the centurion in Acts 10, right? He gave money to a synagogue. The reason why he did is because he was a member of the synagogue. I mean, when's the last time you sat down and wrote a check to an organization that you had no knowledge of and had, you know, I mean, you didn't have anything to do with it or what it was about? Is that your practice to do? No, I mean, come on. Cornelius gave to the poor. He gave to the community. He gave to a synagogue, right? Because he was connected to a synagogue. That's why. And he had the resources, and that's what he wanted to do with them. But the point is that this tension is occasioned by the Torah because of how frequently the Hebrew Bible talks about God's relationship with his people. And Gentiles don't appreciate that they, if they walk in the ways of God's people, can be connected to God in exactly the same way as the Jews are, right? And there is no difference between them, right? But this isn't something that is taught. What is taught is that we are special because the people who were special to God have been set aside. And we are special because we are now in the place they occupied. So that makes us special. And unfortunately, it preserves the animosity, the tension, the enmity occasioned by the Torah, right? Which is why anti-Semitism has been so virulent in Christian-Jewish relationships, right? I mean, so I realize that answer was probably a lot longer than you expected, but that's the bottom line.
That's fine. I just was wanting to try to understand a little better.
Yeah.
And I thank you. I do have, and this may seem, I don't know, as a Gentile who is a believer and who is following Torah, I can obey more than just the 7 Noahide laws, right?
Yes. Yes, the Torah, according to the sages, is for everyone, not just for the Jewish people. And we'll see that to its fullest extent when the Messiah comes and sets up the kingdom, because then the Torah will be the Torah for all nations, not just for Israel. And there are passages that speak to it. I included one in the notes today. I didn't get a chance to read it like I wanted to, but it's in the notes. It's in the notes today. It's the passage. It's the passage from Isaiah 14. The passage from Isaiah 14. No. Sorry, that's not it. I don't see it, but the passage that speaks about the law being the law for the nations in the millennium, right when the Messiah comes, he rules and reigns. There are several passages which address this. Yeah, Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2-3, Micah chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 14. These are passages that are mentioned in the notes, but there are many others that speak to it, right? The fact is that because the law of Messiah is the law of Moses in the way that's reflected in the way the Messiah lived his life and reflects the way that Moses, what Moses intended when he gave the Torah, when he gave the law, yes, believers can observe the Torah. Now, there are some in the Jewish community who would say, no, Gentiles shouldn't observe the instructions given to Israel. They should just observe the Noahide commandments. But there are many passages in the rabbinic literature that speak of the fact that the Torah was given to Israel in the wilderness and not in the land of Israel, because it's for everyone, not just for the Jews. It's for the Gentiles too. And in Isaiah 56, God speaks about the Gentiles, about the stranger and the foreigner. And, you know, others, non-Jews, who observe the Torah, who observe Shabbat, who do the things that the Torah indicates. And that's one of the passages where it speaks of the fact that they will be given a name greater than that of sons and daughters. But, of course, that's an idiom. The idiom expresses the idea that they will be made equal with sons and daughters. They're connected to God in the same way that Israel is connected with God, even if they're not a physical descendant, you know, of a Jewish person. They can be connected to the people of Israel through their observance of Torah, through their relationship with God, which is exactly what Paul talks about in his letter to the Romans. In his letter to the Ephesians, he talks about Gentiles being grafted among the natural branches of the olive tree, right, in Romans 11, not in place of the olive tree, like many translations say, but among the natural branches. And in Ephesians, you know, Paul writes that the Gentiles, you know, frankly, are excluded from the promises and the covenants that God made with his people, right? But in the Messiah, they are in included. They become connected to God's people, attached to God's promises, to God's covenant with Israel. Covenants, many covenants, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, right? The Davidic covenant, these are all made. The covenant with Pinchas, they are all made with Israel, right? The only one that's not is the one with Noah. And Noah is made with everyone. It's even made with the animals, right? The Noah covenant is made with the animals, right? But of course, the laws associated with the Noah covenant in Genesis 9 are for people, the nations. So, Gentiles are obligated to observe the Torah, the seven instructions that God gave Noah, right? But when a person comes to Messiah in the first century, they were connected to existing synagogues. That's just what happened, right? And that's the way the book of Acts describes the early moving of the kingdom of heaven. What happened is that Gentiles were already in synagogues when they heard the preaching or the proclamation regarding Yeshua as the Messiah. In some cases, they embrace Yeshua as the Messiah, but they stay in the synagogue, as do the Jews who embrace Yeshua as the Messiah. They stay in the synagogue. And the only time they leave a synagogue is if there is pressure to go, if there are issues with those believing Jews and Gentiles in a non-messianic synagogue, they leave and they create a synagogue of their own, right? I mean, every Jew on the planet in the first century knew how to start a synagogue, because whenever they moved to a community, if it had 10 Jews, they were obligated to start a synagogue, right? You don't need a rabbi to start a synagogue. You just need a quorum, and that's just 10 Jews. And you get 10 Jews together, you can read from the Torah and study what the words mean. And read from the Haftorah, the prophets. That's what happens in a synagogue, along with whatever liturgy had been developed by that time. But that's what Jews are used to doing. So it wasn't this big undertaking to create their own community, right? They withdrew from a non-messianic synagogue. If they were required to, they would establish their own congregation. And in some cases, these congregations, fell under the leadership of someone like Barnabas or Paul or Peter or any number of other people who would have supported them and given them instruction and drawn alongside of them to help them find their way, right? But the fact is that's what went on. And it went on that way until the number of Gentiles increased so significantly that they began to outnumber the number of Jews in these congregations, right? And then, in the middle of the second century, this old tension erupts again, in part because of what the Gentiles thought God was doing among his people. The destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, the number of casualties in the Bar Kokhba revolt, right? I mean, there are foreshadowing. There's a foreshadowing of some of this in the earliest of the teachings of the church fathers, right? But the fact is that just like us, when you embrace Yeshua as the Messiah, you don't change overnight. We change over time. Right? So some of this tension and animosity, it has to change over time. But the number of Gentiles involved in these congregations, they overwhelmed these communities and brought some of these tensions and, wrong ideas into their community experience, right, over time. And then these tensions emerged and were, were really grounded by the teaching of the early church fathers in the second and third centuries that, that really interpreted what had taken place to Israel as an evidence that God had turned away from his people and raised up a spiritual Israel in their place, right? And by the fourth century, that was confirmed with the legalization of Christianity in the Roman Empire, right? I mean, they saw that as an indication that God had confirmed their view, their perception, that they had indeed replaced Israel as God's chosen people, right? And then part of their objective was to get rid of the former chosen people, right? Either to get rid of them or to use them to be an evidence of their superiority and Israel's rejection, right? So that everyone could see that the church was superior and Israel had been rejected, right? So it kind of morphs all the way to the Holocaust in the 20th century. I hope that answered that, Beth Ann. I apologize that one was so long, too.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Rabbi.
That's why I keep reminding Ed when he brings it up. Quick question. There's no such thing as a quick... There are quick questions, but no quick answers.
I was going to say I enjoyed the answer and the question.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate it. Very good.
I have a question that, why come the, you said the Noah, or what was the law of Noah?
Yeah,
by the nation?
Yeah.
How come that was never included in there? I mean, if it is, it's just a little part. I mean, how come the Gentiles didn't follow the Noah law?
Yeah, ironically, in many ways, the Gentiles have observed the Noahic laws, the Noahic covenantal laws, except, of course, the one law is that it prohibits engaging in idolatry, which the Gentiles obviously have not embraced or adopted. And Paul explains the reason why in his letter to the Romans, in the first chapter of his letter to the Romans. He says that Gentiles willingly and knowingly turned away from God, right? They turned away from God and made a decision, a willful, deliberate decision, to engage in idolatry as opposed to worshiping him. And I would guess that part of the reason for that is that God is unseen, and it's difficult even for us to appreciate God's presence with us when we either don't see it or feel it, right? So it's not a big surprise, unfortunately, that nations carved images and likenesses and made statues and worship God, under every green tree in the Bible. But the point is that the nations traded God for idols. But they did that deliberately, intentionally.
That's why it's not in the Bible. I mean, look like it's, I don't understand. So that's why it never was in the regular Bible for them to talk about it. Is this a little portion?
It is. It is a little portion, but that's the way. But you see, Gentiles in the first century who would have been attending synagogues, they would have known this because it was being taught, right? So in the first century, Gentiles would have been taught what the Noahide commandments were because they would have been connected to a community where these things were taught. And by the way, Gentiles would have been discouraged then too from converting to Judaism for the same reasons I mentioned earlier, because it adds to someone's obligation, you know, obligations. It changes their status, obviously, but it also adds obligations and responsibilities, right? Which, anyway, that's another... I was going to say something else, but it's another subject. The point is that one of the laws requires setting up a government, right? Well, all nations have governments. Most nations have governments. Most communities have governments, right? So government is something, is one of the laws that most Gentiles observe. There are many others, like, for example, not killing, not murdering. Murdering is another law that most Gentiles observe. Not ripping a live animal apart and eating it. That's something that is prohibited to Gentiles too. And probably most Gentiles do follow that one. Right? So there are several that most Gentiles probably engage without realizing it. You know, I agree with you. They probably do it without realizing it. And it's because... It's because the connection between Jews and Gentiles was severed in such a way so that Gentiles, in Christian teaching, Gentiles have no obligation to Torah, so why read it or study it at all, right? I mean, I wish I had a nickel for every Christian I've encountered in my 50 years of travels who carried around with them a copy of the New Testament, but not the Old. It was just the New Testament. They didn't have the Old Testament because they didn't need it. What's the point? Sometimes I've seen copies of the New Testament with the Book of Psalms, right? But apart from that, very few Christians read the Hebrew Bible, read the Tanakh, because they've been taught that it has nothing to do with them. It's not relevant to them. That's why. But the fact is...
But they don't go by the Noah part of it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, they don't because they're unaware of it.
Exactly, because I was unaware of it.
Yes.
Can I interject a thought here on this?
Absolutely.
I think, Benita, part of why it exists this way, or by how it's come down, is in some part because of the way history got written. When you think about monotheism, the religions of the world that believe in only one God, Judaism, Islam, Muslim, and Christianity. And so when you think about Gentiles having access to the Noahide laws, those Noahide laws were there ever since Moses wrote the Torah, which would go back to the time period that Israel was wandering in the wilderness. So from that time forward, we've had the text. But in terms of Gentiles being aware of that text, unless the Gentiles had associated themselves and aligned themselves with Israel, they would have not have been exposed to the text. And so that raises a question. Before the Common Era, what Gentiles, if any, worshiped the one true God? Well, We don't know. We know that there were some Gentiles who lived among the Israelites, even later as they took and occupied the land of promise, Eretz Israel. There were some population of Gentiles that were living there and associated and aligned themselves with Israel. But in terms of a larger or a bigger picture of Gentiles who would have known about the Noahide laws and walked in the ways of the Lord and worshiped the one true God, we just don't know because nobody wrote about it. Whenever you read in history about ancient peoples and their religion, it's always the religions that were polytheistic. They had multiple gods, many gods, Hindus, Buddhists, and Taoism, and etc., right? So we don't really see any history about religions that worship the one God, the only one that we read about that's in terms of history would be the Jews among the ancient peoples. And then when we come into the common era, then we're introduced to Christianity and Muslim. Islam wasn't established until the 6th century of the common era. And Christianity began to be established by the 2nd or the 3rd or the 4th century. And so the early church fathers intentionally didn't write about it. And so once again, for Gentiles to even be aware of the Noahide laws, they would have had to be going to synagogue. They had to be living in a Jewish community. They had to be aligned with Jews, even in the first century, because the early church fathers of Christianity weren't writing about this. And it's a sad commentary, really, in many ways. But someone in the Muslim culture of the 6th and 7th and 8th century was much more likely to be aware of these laws than Christians.
Yes. Sadly.
Yeah.
By the way, thanks, Roderick. I appreciate the explanation. Ed posted this for us. This comes from Genesis chapter 9. In verse 24 is the instruction not to worship idols. Number 2 is not to curse God. Not to commit murder in verse 25. Not to commit adultery or sexual immorality, engage in sexual immorality. Not stealing is 26, 27 is not stealing. Not eating the flesh torn from a living animal, and to establish courts of justice, right? So you can see that these laws, to what extent they're followed, that's an entirely different matter. But you can see that these laws have been integrated into the laws of probably most of the world's cultures, right? So how they became aware of them or how they were integrated. It's possible in the beginning that this information was passed along orally, right? Like many instructions and laws were. Just like the oral Torah, it was passed along orally for centuries, right? Very accurately. And so that's something that was done among the Gentiles too. Of course, and then there are written copies of these things as well. Good. Thanks, Roderick. Thanks, Benita. Appreciate you posting this, Ed. Thank you.
You're welcome. Would the Noahidic laws have been discussed in the oral Torah, or would that have been?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Well, that was a fast answer. I take back what I said. So you get a fast answer, every 12, 15 years? Good.
I appreciate your thoroughness. It helps a lot.
Very good. Anybody else before we go?
Yes, Rabbi. One of the things that also it's part of the problem is that we do not go deep, you know, in the information because, I mean, we need to read it before understand it and stay conscious about it. So, for example, when I read in Acts 15 in the Jerusalem Council, it says, "It is in my judgment, it is my judgment, therefore, that we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. Instead, we should write to them, telling them to abstain from food polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, and from the meat of strangled animals, and from blood." But then it says, "For the law of Moses has been preached in every city from the earliest time, and is read in the synagogues on every Shabbat." So in my understanding is that the disciples trust that if the Gentiles are genuinely interested in the Torah, so they will go to the synagogues to hear, and the more they hear, the more they will understand what is all this about, you know? And so I think that that yes, in one side is about history and how the things have been handled by the people who has been in charge of the Christian traditions, but in the other side is part of how the Gentiles we haven't been so interested to know and to seek more information, you know? So, because one of the things that it's also in the Bible is, I mean, these categories that the Torah has made about the people who is seeking God, I mean, the gate proselytes, the God-fearers, and the proselytes, which are, I mean, at the end of the day, is the people who convert to Judaism, right? But the other two groups of people that are Gentiles are very important in history and are also important now. So we start as a Gentile taking conscious about Noahide's laws, but we can go further as God-fearers and trying to connect with God, not because He will bless me more, or I will be more close to Him, just because of obedience and because I want to know more about Him, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, in the first century, Gentiles were in synagogues. They were connected to synagogues. And as they embraced Yeshua as the Messiah and came to worship God, that's what happens. Which is why, like you said, you know, they understood what authors were writing to them, because they understood it from a Jewish perspective, not a Western perspective, right? They appreciated the fact that words were used like they were used in Hebrew, not in Greek, right? So that's an important issue. And the reason why that is not known today is because, I mean, I can give you a very, very simple example. Yeshua said in the Sermon on the Mount, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light, right? There's so many different ways that word has been translated. If your eye is sound, if your eye is whole, if your eye is complete, if your eye, you know, I mean, all kinds of interpretations. Ironically, the exact same word is used in the Hebrew Bible, right? In the Proverbs. If your eye is good, it's a reference to being generous. If your eye is evil, it's a reference to being stingy, right? So in other words, in the Sermon on the Mount, Yeshua, he's not saying anything about the character or the integrity or the color or the soundness of the eye, right? He's talking about the person. A person with a good eye is a generous person. A person with a bad eye or an evil eye is a stingy person, right? This is not an opinion. This is the way the language works, right? It's an idiom. These two expressions contain two Hebrew idioms, which are used repeatedly in rabbinic literature, in the Bible, in the Proverbs in particular. And even in modern Hebrew, these terms, these idioms, are still used, right? The fact is that if someone was familiar with the Proverbs, they would know what this expression meant. But because they're not, they don't. And, you know, frankly, it's sad that the translation committee is unaware of the use of this word or this idiom in the Proverbs, and therefore mistranslates an important passage of Scripture that has something to do with connecting the spirit and the letter of the Torah together in our lives, right? So it's missed. It's ignored. Was it deliberate? Was it intentional? Hard to know. But you would think that the translations would be better, but they're not. Right? It's sad.
Bob, I have a humorous story.
Yeah.
And it's not a joke. This is something that actually happened. Many years ago, Melody and I and the kids, we were living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I had a very dear close friend of mine that was employed with a well-known TV evangelist. And this TV evangelist often bragged about his knowledge of Hebrew. And he was notorious for using Hebrew stuff to make money and to get people to contribute to his organization. He sold shofars and tallits and mezuzah covers and so forth. Well, he was still running short, so he decided to have this huge campaign and published it in a full-size magazine. And on the cover of the magazine are these Hebrew words and Hebrew text. And then, of course, he gives his translation of it. And my friend brought me a copy that had just been sent out to like a million people. And when I saw it, I started laughing. And my friend's name was Dub. And Dub, he says, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "Evidently he doesn't know Hebrew because he published this with all the letters backwards."
Yeah, that's funny.
He could not pick up the phone fast enough to call his boss.
Mine.
Who was livid and lost it. And I can't stop laughing.
Yeah.
Somewhere in my files, I still have a copy of that.
Well, if you come across it sometime, send me a copy, would you?
You know, it's like, my dad used to tell me an idiom. And he's from Kentucky, so I think this was a Kentucky idiom. Give a man enough rope, he'll hang himself.
Yeah.
Well, I think I watched it happen that day.
Yeah. 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 Very good. I think there's a... Thanks, Roderick. That was... appreciate the story. From Susanna, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. The Bible is replete with teaching and passages in following God's law not hard to see and understand the blessing that comes from it. Yet at the same time, it takes eyesight, teaching, and understanding from the Ruach, the Spirit, to see it's not burdensome as Christian theology teaches. I don't think most Christians realize this teaching is a replacement of replacement, reflection of replacement theology. I didn't. So question, do you think if more Christians attended synagogues with sincere heart to learn the Torah and the Hebrew perspective, they would be welcomed? I think, it's been my experience that Gentiles are welcomed in synagogues, but depending upon the community, depending upon the rabbi and the community, the initial exposure is not without its issues, right? And the issue is that the Gentile, a Christian, who wants to attend a synagogue, is suspected of wanting to attend the synagogue to evangelize the Jews and to convert them to Christianity, right? So, if a Christian goes to a synagogue, it has to be with the objective that you mentioned, right? Learning the Jewish perspective, learning what the Torah says, how we apply these principles to our lives. It has to be honest and genuine. If a Christian is going to a synagogue to evangelize Jews and to convert them to Christianity, they shouldn't, right? Because they just give Christians a bad name. And it makes it more difficult for a Christian who has a genuine interest in these things to be accepted. Because this has been done, of course, right? The other thing is that the members of the community, not always, and not all, but are sometimes suspicious of the person's motives, right? But I don't think I've ever been in a synagogue where there hasn't been non-Jews involved and regarded as a part of the community, and they attend classes and studies, and right? I mean, you know, they're accepted the way anybody might be. And by the way, it's same for Jewish day schools, right? They don't just take Jews, they take non-Jews too. So a person could put their non-Jewish son or daughter into a Jewish day school, and they could learn in that application too. So there is an initial kind of tension that has to be overcome, but once that tension is overcome, it works out. It typically works out pretty well. At least it has in my experience. She continues, I was just thinking this morning why my Christian friends who have a love for the Jews and Israel don't go to synagogue with me. Not to be judgmental or harsh, but just wonder sometimes, right? And the reason why they don't is because they've been taught that the Torah is not relevant, that Jewish things reflect a legalism that interferes with your relationship with God. So if you go to the synagogue, if you attend services for various holidays, you're engaging in legalism. And that, of course, has nothing to do with what legalism actually means. And I would be surprised if you haven't been labeled a Judaizer in doing that, right? I mean, and that's not what being a Judaizer means either. Being a Judaizer is not embracing Jewish customs or a worldview. Being a Judaizer is expressing the view that Gentiles can't be saved without converting to Judaism. That's what a Judaizer is. I mean, everyone in the Bible encouraged people to walk in God's ways, right? To observe Shabbat, observe the holidays, walk in God's ways, observe the Torah, they're not Judaizers, right? I mean, it's unfortunate that the term legalism and Judaizers are used the way they are, because they're not employed with proper definitions. Nobody knows what people think they're talking about has nothing to do with what the words actually mean. Right? It's an issue too. At any rate, you would think that if a Christian had a heart for Jewish things, I mean, what more natural place would there be to go than a synagogue, right? But most are kind of intimidated by the use of Hebrew, or, you know, because they don't understand Hebrew, or this way the service works, how long it lasts, you know. I mean, a Torah service in a conservative or a Orthodox synagogue can last 3 hours, right? I mean, Westerners are typically not, most Westerners can't even watch a good movie that lasts for 3 hours, let alone attend a service that lasts that long. You know, I mean, in many places, I mean, you could pretty much count off the clock. The parts of the service are very structured, very ordered, and they start at 10 and are over at 11, or 9 and over at 10, whatever it might be, right? I mean, if you're not there exactly on time, you miss the beginning, and if you're, and at the end, you know, the pastor's in the outside the rear doors greeting people as they leave. I mean, and even that is long for some people. Oh, here's something from Rivka. Here's a Wikipedia link on the Noetic laws rather than a religious source. They are well known in the world. I think Christianity discourages anything related to Judaism as a type of Judaizing. Yes. Yep, that's true. So here's the Wikipedia link, right? And like Roderick said, I mean, you know, there is a much greater awareness of the laws given to Noah now than there was in biblical times. But I agree. I think Rivka's right. I think people are discouraged. Gentiles are discouraged from reading the Noahide laws or the Noetic laws, because they're taught that they're a part of a Torah that's not relevant today, right? So why bother? I mean, yep, I agree. I think that is a type of Judaizing, which of course it isn't, you know. Very good. So from Benita, yes, go ahead.
I was going to say that those Noahide laws, several come right from the commandment, the Ten Commandments, right?
Yes, but the Ten Commandments, don't forget, came later. So what it would probably be better to say is that the instructions that God gives to Israel, the Noahide instructions are integrated into them. And you're right. The commandment not to murder, not to commit adultery, not to steal, you know, to worship God and God alone. Those are a part of the Ten Commandments. So you can see how important they are, right? But those Ten Commandments, or ten words, in Hebrew, are regarded as a summary of the entire body of instructions. Those aren't the only important ones. They're regarded as a summary of the whole, right? So, the commandments that God gave to Noah came, you know, much, much earlier. than the instructions given to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. Also from Rivka, to what Dr. Roderick said, there is always the teeny things that shows the fraud, like the hand gesture in Inglorious Bastards. Right, she's, I don't know if you've seen the movie Inglorious Bastards, but it involves a group of Jews engaged in guerrilla operations against Nazi forces. They're underground or undercover in Nazi-controlled areas. And someone asks one of the undercover guys about the number three. So he does this. He holds up three fingers, right? The problem is that in Germany, this is not the way they show the number three. It's like this. Right, so when the guy held up three fingers like this, the Nazi who was questioning him knew he wasn't a German. Right? And of course, a big fight ensues, as you can imagine, with everybody in the bar against everybody who had entered the bar undercover. Anyway, it's kind of a cute scene. So that's the one Rivka's referring to, but her observation is correct, right? It's little things that provide evidence of the agenda, right? Also from Susanna, I sadly have to agree with you. It breaks my heart, but true. I fear these things may be starting to separate us, though I know they love the Lord, but sense something may be changing even with me, especially in these times when Israel is at war. Yes, good point. Initial tension would need to be overcome and a trust built. Yeah, thank you for your reply. Yeah, this, I probably neglected to mention this. When a non-Jew goes to a synagogue, they have to build trust with the members of the community. So that's a good point. Thank you, Susanna. From Beth Ann, sadly, I can remember my dad, as well as others, getting upset if the service lasted more than an hour when I was growing up. Yep, that is often the case. The sign for W, or the number three, yes, from Rivka. Right. So, very good. So, thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
The lesson referenced the Shotrim?
Shotrim, yeah.
When you were reading it, I was thinking about what happened in Judges 7 with Gideon.
Yes.
And how, I guess he wanted some assurance from the Lord that he was going to go with them in this battle. And, you know, he gave instructions about how to whittle down the number of soldiers going with him. Was that an example of that, or was it something very different?
That's a good observation. I would say that was a reflection of that principle in our portion, right? That if someone was scared or someone wasn't prepared to go into battle, then they shouldn't, right? Because, you know, they might, if they weren't paying attention to their surroundings, then it was likely or more likely that they would become a casualty in the conflict, right? So that's what Jeremiah watches when the people kneel down at the spring. It's known as Gideon's Spring these days. And we often go there on our trips to Israel, but you go to the spring, and of course everybody wants to lap up some water from it, but if you lap water up with your hands while you're kind of glancing around at what's going on, it's evidence that you're prepared to go into battle, and if you don't do that, you're not. So, yeah, that would be an application in my view. That's a good observation. I think it would be an application of this instruction given in Deuteronomy, in this passage from Deuteronomy chapter 20. Yeah, good.
I related it because I'm thinking here is the Lord letting Gideon and his 300 know that regardless of how many people he sends into battle, the battle will be won. And the Shofaris essentially enforcing that when they told people that were scared or had a new house or whatever, you can go back because it's going to be all right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because the success in battle depends on God. And that's... And frankly, that's something that the others need to know, but know too. Right, so, yeah, good point. Very good. Okay. Yeah, Ray, go ahead.
I kind of think that this also speaks to the subject of unity amongst the troops, is that they don't have a divided mindset. They have a totally focused unity, like when in the very beginning when the Lord says, you know, they're all of one language and they'll be able to do anything that they want.
Yeah.
And they think of, well, that's kind of the way it is when they go into battle. If everybody's focused on the mission and only the mission, no distractions, pretty darn lethal force.
Yes.
And that's where it's got to be. That's what they express in our mindset of the woods there.
Yeah, and that's something, by the way, that, I mean, I would guess it's probably emphasized in the training that soldiers undergo in boot camp, right? That's something certainly emphasized in Marine Corps boot camp, you know, this idea of, you know, coalescing as a unit and the kind of advantage that provides in battle, right? But yeah, that's a good point too. Very good. Let's see. There's a couple of others from Bonita. Great study. Thank you. From Charlene. Thank you. Shalom all. I think Charlene had to go. From Viola, is the anti-Messiah like Pharaoh and will we be here when he comes? The anti-Messiah, there are probably some associations or connections between the anti-Messiah and Pharaoh. Pharaoh thought he was God, for example. The anti-Messiah will aspire to be like God, to be God. So it's true that way. The Pharaoh ignored God. The anti-Messiah ignores the true God. So in some ways he's like Pharaoh. Whether we will or will not be here when he comes depends on when you or I or anyone else among us goes to be with the Lord. And it depends on how soon this may happen. I mean, if it happens in 100 years, none of us are going to be here for it, right? So who knows? I'm not sure when this event might take place. I know everybody thinks it's imminent, but people have been thinking it's imminent since the first century. So, from Keith, thanks everyone, enjoyed our study. Shalom all. heavy burdens. I'm not sure what the reference is to. Heavy burdens, if that's a reference to sometimes the way life works, then yes, life can, you know, we all experience heavy burdens in many ways. And hopefully the connection that we have to each other and some of the things that we talk about and, you know, help us to transition through it. All right. Good. Very good. Thank you. Anybody else before we go?
Yes, Rabbi, 2 Thessalonians 2, read it more. There's a reference in here. The one who now holds it back will continue to do so till he is taken out of the way. So who is the he is taken out of the way? I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, I think the he. What's the translation, by the way?
Well, I'm reading from the notes that were posted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's
that's the NIV.
Oh, okay. Second to the last.
Okay, 2 Thessalonians. Oh, here it is. Okay, the he would be a reference to the Holy Spirit. That the, essentially God, I mean God, you know, the physical but invisible presence of God is restraining the coming forth of the Antichrist, right? And if you were to read Peter, Peter would say that he is doing that because he wants everyone to come to repentance, right? In other words, the reason why it has taken so long for all of these events that are mentioned in the scripture to transpire is because God wants people to turn to him, and he wants them to have opportunities too, which, by the way, we're a part of, right? We're a part of the opportunities that people have to turn to God, to walk in God's ways or to know God, right? Through whatever connection we have with people, right? So the he would be the physical, invisible presence of God, right? But sometimes interpreted, even though the pronoun doesn't warrant it, sometimes applied to the church in dispensational theology. In other words, when the church is raptured out of the world, then the last 7 years of world history begin. Right, that's when the time of Jacob's trouble begins. And that would be a pre-millennial perspective. Right, that the church is raptured out of the world before this time of Jacob's trouble begins. And then, of course, they're seated in the heavenly grandstand and watch all of the nations on earth go to battle with each other. You know, kind of like watching that Chiefs-Ravens game. Right.
Thank you, Rabbi. And one more thing is the statement here that Satan facilitates bondage, conformity, and ignorance. It seems to me that conformity and ignorance are devices or tools that the enemy uses to, in a way, almost like very secretly or in a way that you're not aware that you're coming into bondage because of this conformity and ignorance.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think this is, I think there is biblical evidence of this as well. Like, for example, when Satan incites David, King David, to number his troops, for example, right? David, he probably didn't think about it. He didn't probably give it any thought at all. He just, you know, this thought comes up. Hey, buddy, you should number the troops. It might give you a better feel for, you know, for, you know, your military ability to confront an enemy, right? And, I mean, it sounds rational and it makes sense. And so you think to yourself, yeah, you know, that's a great idea. I think I'll do that. But, of course, talking about what Ed had brought up before with Gideon, you know, I mean, how effective we are in conflict, in battle, doesn't depend on our numbers. It's not supposed to. That's why Jews don't count people. Right? There is a fictional way of doing it. Right? But the fact is that, you know, we don't count people. David should have known, but Satan's, the way he works is very subtle. And I would say that few people are probably aware of the fact that they are being manipulated at the time it's happening. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Good observation. Good.
And I think also because when King David probably looked at the other nations that were around him and thought, well, they do the same thing.
Yep.
For their military prowess.
Absolutely. Everybody does. And by the way, everybody does it today, too. I mean, there are websites you can go on. You can find out exactly how many tanks China has, the Soviet Union has, the United States has, Israel has. You can find out exactly how many aircraft they have, how many troops they have, everything, all of their military components are numbered, right? Because it's a way of assessing their relative strength, right? So it's possible on the basis of this for experts to say, you know, the United States is militarily superior to Russia, therefore should win a conflict against Russia or a war against Russia or against China, right? And every time, like recently, when the Chinese produce a new aircraft carrier, there are always questions posed regarding how does that upset the existing balance, right? And it's always about numbers, because the Western world is preoccupied with numbers. It's a Western thing, not an Israeli thing, not a Jewish thing. Right? Yeah, the Western world is obsessed with numbers. Yeah. Good observation. Thanks, David. Anyone else have something to add to this conversation? Numbers is a tempting subject.
Prepare for 3 hours.
What's that?
Prepare for those 3 hours.
Yeah, let's see here. Ooh, we're probably close to a record.
Actually, I have another question, Rabbi. When the Bible talks about people being cast into out of darkness where there's gnashing of teeth and this kind of misery, where exactly is that place?
Where does that what?
Where is that place?
Expressions like that?
Well, it talks about, in the Bible, it talks about when God, there are people that come before God, and God says that when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. And then the people respond, well, when did we see you hungry and give you drink? And then God said, if you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And then the others come, and God says, away from me, because when I was hungry, you did not feed me. You didn't put me in prison. And those are cast into outer darkness where there's national teaching. I just kind of wonder, where is this outer darkness?
The outer darkness, that's a great question, too. The outer darkness is a metaphor for Sheol, the place of the grave, right? In other words, when a person dies, by the way, the body is not the person. The soul is the person. We've talked about that before. The body is the tent. It's put into the ground or buried into the ground. And when it's in the ground, it's in a place of outer darkness or inner darkness. It's just an expression. It just means a place of darkness. The expression, the weeping and gnashing of teeth, those are idioms associated with torment, right? So in Jewish thought, there has developed this notion or idea that when the wicked die, they are incarcerated in an area of Sheol where they are in torment, where they are in outer darkness, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. But the righteous, they are gathered together in what's referred to as paradise, or Abraham's bosom. It's also a place in Sheol, but there they are not in torment. They are not weeping. They are awaiting the coming of the Messiah to announce his presence and then to take them into the presence of God, to take them to heaven, which is something that Paul says Yeshua did when he descended into the heart of the earth. He proclaimed his presence to the souls in prison and ascended with this host in captivity, or with him, taken captive essentially, into God's presence, so that they are there in God's presence now, right? But the term is also associated with the final destination of Satan and the angels who rebelled against God with him, the lake of fire, right? So Gehenna, the lake of fire, comes from the Hebrew word Gai Hinnom, Gai Ben Hinnom, or Gai Hinnom, the Valley of Hinnom. The Valley of Hinnom in the Bible is the same as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. It's a valley to the west of Jerusalem where Molech was worshipped in biblical times, and where infants were burned in the fire as they were offered to the god Molech. It became a place where trash was discarded and burned. The bodies of dead animals were discarded and burned. And so it became a place of continual burning. And it was outside the walls on the western side of the city of Jerusalem. So it became a place of refuse, right? Refuse, things that were discarded, anything that was discarded and needed to be burned was taken there and burned. So it becomes a metaphor for this eternal state of burning and the torment and the you know, the torment that is associated with burning, right? The only problem, of course, is that in the scriptures it is characterized both as a place of eternal fire and as a place of outer darkness. And those two don't go together, right? I mean, burning produces light, and darkness is something that exists in the absence of burning, right? But the various metaphors are used to describe the ultimate destination of Satan, the angels that rebelled against God with him, and the wicked, right? That's the ultimate destination of the wicked. So, apart from that, we don't know much about it. It's difficult to know if whether or not the torment is eternal in terms of some, you know, the problem is that we associate burning in the lake of fire or being in outer darkness, we associate them with physical properties. And this is a non-physical place. So it might mean a place where one's separation from God is preserved. They've separated themselves from God, and that separation is preserved eternally. It's kind of a scary thing to think about. And by the way, people are alone there. Satan does not rule there. He's incarcerated or sent there like everyone else. Satan is not in charge of it. That view comes from Dante's Inferno, not from the scripture. Yeah, Satan is not in charge in Gehenna. Yeah, very good. Hope that answered it. It's, you know, there isn't a good deal said about it, unfortunately. Very good. From Viola, there is the rapture of the unrighteous. The rapture is not a biblical term. Both the righteous and the unrighteous undergo a metamorphosis. They change. The righteous, they are transformed they acquire a spiritual body. The righteous acquire a spiritual body. The physical body is whatever happens to it, whether it's buried or whatever happens to the physical body is not irrelevant, but it's the spiritual body that one acquires that enables them to be in God's presence and to see him as he is, according to Paul and John in their letters. And the wicked, of course, they transition into, see, the spirit soul is eternal, right? So it's non-material, right? The only thing that we lose is the physical part of the body, right? Which is, well, you can see that it is the least important part, given the fact that in Hebrew, we don't even have a word for body. Biblical Hebrew. There is in modern Hebrew. But in biblical Hebrew, there's no word for body, the body of a man. That's why man is not a body, a soul, and a spirit. There is no Hebrew word for body. That's a Greek invention. Those categories are Greek, not biblical. In Hebrew, a person is their inner being and their outer reputation. What they are like on the inside, which is their true nature, and the way that nature is reflected on the outside, right? Which is what people see. So, very good. Thank you, Viola. From Susanna, does the Israeli army use the teaching in today's Torah about sending a frightened or newly married soldier home? You may have answered it. I missed it. You know, that's a good question. I don't know if they, if this, these principles are applied directly, but I would guess that they are applied. In terms of what job a person might be given, you know, being in a non-combat role as opposed to an active combat role. And I do know that the Israeli army does follow other Torah principles with regard to combat. For example, warning people of an invasion, for example. Warning people that something is going to happen at a particular location. Right, so that is something that frankly, from a warfare standpoint, you know, it completely removes the element of surprise, which is employed by many and has been employed by many for, I mean, it says an important part of the art of war as anything. Israel sacrifices it in order to avoid as many civilian casualties as possible. Obviously, that's not always possible, but, you know, but people are given time to get out of the way of a upcoming bombing, for example, right? So, it doesn't guarantee that there will be no civilian casualties, but its objective is to minimize them. So they do follow principles like that. I'm not sure about these others. Sorry. Okay. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Okay. Well, since this is the month of Elul, we typically have the shofar sounded every day, hear the sound of the shofar. It is an important reference to the idea that the king is in the field, that the king is in the field walking among his people. Aviv texted me earlier regarding the blowing of the shofar, so we'll let him blow the shofar, ask him to blow the shofar on our behalf so that we can hear it. In the month of Elul, this month of forgiveness in the run-up to the high holy days of the new year. Hard to believe that we're that close to it. Wow. Very good. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and command us to hear the sound of the shofar.
Amen. Thank you. So may the Lord bless us and keep us and prepare us for the upcoming high holidays and to spend this time with our loved ones, with each other, with the Lord, and equip us to embrace the New Year's challenges that I'm sure will come. So may Hashem be with you and extend his great care to you. Amen. Very good. Good to see everybody. God bless you.
Shalom.
Ray will be praying for your surgery, Ray, on the 10th.
Yeah, Tuesday.
Tuesday, yep.
Tuesday morning.
Very good. His knee replacement.
Okay, thank you, Avi.
Yeah, very good.
That was beautiful.
Very
yeah,
good.
Of course.
Thank you.
Shabbat shalom.
Be blessed, all.
Shabbat shalom.
Thank you. Blessings to all. Shabbat shalom.
Bye for now.